Welcome to Mobile by Design, Episode 2, a podcast about all things app development and design. On today's episode, we're exploring the many ways banking, finance, and insurance are affecting today's digital consumers. I am joined today by Paul Nold, the director of NRV, a venture capital firm, Chris Mowry, director of UX strategy and engineering at Capital One, and Jamie Young, the director of experience design here at Shaco. Our panel investigates the many problems facing finance tech today, the most exciting trends on the horizon, and where tech can measurably improve the lives of finance consumers tomorrow. Almost sweating it out in our soon-to-be-fixed podcast room. Hello and welcome to the Shaco podcast. My name is Mason Brown. Today we're going to do a podcast on utility in the financial industry. I'm joined today with a couple of guests from the industry and from Shaco as well. We're just going to start with one of our Shaco employees. Jamie, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, my name's Jamie Young. I'm the UX lead at Shaco.
How about you?
Yeah, sure. Hey, I'm Paul Nolde. I'm a director at NRV, which is an early stage venture capital firm based in Richmond, and we invest in the fintech space.
Hi, I'm Chris Mowry. I'm an IT director at Capital One.
Cool. And I'm Mason Brown, and I'm a UX guy at Shaco. So we're going to kind of start off with a broad question to kind of kick us off. But how would you guys define utility in the financial space through mobile applications or digital tools?
I'll take a stab at kicking it off, and then my much more intelligent panelists will help me. I'm seeing it or talking about it through an investor's eyes. When we look at utility in the space, that obviously drives user adoption and scale and revenues and all of those things. We look at, you know, where is that particular platform or that particular product or app, entering the customer's or consumer's financial life. And so we kind of look at it as, you know, as a wedge into their wallet. So is it coming through the Capital One? I mean, the credit card space. That is not an advertisement, although I like Capital One. Is it coming through the credit card side? Is it coming through the banking side, the lending side? And the reason I bring that up is, from a utility standpoint, it's going to matter greatly into how that company executes on their value proposition, which will then I think unlock other revenue streams and ways in which that platform can grow and become more ubiquitous in that individual's and population's kind of financial life. From a business standpoint, from a corporate standpoint, and again, on this theme of utility, there was a great article in TechCrunch that I recently saw about the rise of these novel apps and novel platforms that take a traditional model, banking model, from some of the big banks and actually turn those traditional banking models into platforms, into more tech-savvy platforms. So there are two mindsets inherent in that. One is either you believe that there's going to be some novel mobile platform that's going to be the new bank, and all the things that entail that you think about with a bank, or there's going to be the traditional banks that continue to grab market share and maintain market share, but with technological innovation supplied through bolt-on technologies. And so there's a more symbiotic relationship in that use case. So I don't want to dominate that topic, but I think we look at it as still we're not sure, necessarily if there's going to be a few that win, many that win, but it's exciting either way.
Yeah, and from my perspective, it's a little bit different. So mine's more internal, how can we empower, our workforce to be able to do some of the things that they do on their laptops a lot more simply, right? When you look at utility, like what are some of those key functions and things that they do? How can you make those into like mobile experiences, or, you know, build something for an iPad so they can pick something up, they can do their work quick. So really when you look at that and you take that across the whole enterprise, I think if you can kind of grade that utility, it also helps your consumer, right? So when you're looking at just the banker in the bank, right? If he has something that he can pick up an iPad and say, I can do some work really quickly, I can help this consumer through these like little, almost like microservices, right? That term of utility, that really clean, really crisp, like get in, get out kind of features and functionality, I think is really key.
And I'm looking at it more from a personal banking side or consumer banking side. I've, you know, got less experience with the larger fintech world or like trading or anything like that, but for me, it really ever since Mint was bought by Intuit or Adaptive Path by you guys, Chris, by Capital One,
right.
Just really threw into focus, I think, for a lot of people that the user experience side of things is a huge differentiator in the banking product space. So I'm really looking at, for the most part, like what are those front end experience for the end user. In terms of, you know, seems like more and more, I think numbers are going up for folks easier, faster to switch based on experience or based on an app, and especially with online banks or whatever, virtual banks and things like that, where they're really just coming on top and sitting on top of your guys' services or something like that, but just really competing on a user interface, essentially, for the most part. So, I think was Mint got picked up. They didn't really have any proprietary tech or anything, right? I'm not sure, but I think it was just like a really novel user experience. So, and obviously,
pretty sharps go a long way.
Right?
Well, is it also, you could almost look at it as what Amazon did with the one click, you know, kind of look at it that way, you know, in terms of ease of I think the mass consumer now wants. You know, if it's any more than three steps, three clicks, it's just too onerous, right? So we see that as well. I mean, and again, driving adoption and continued retention of the consumer. Yeah, that's a good point.
I think it's really interesting that, we had this kind of very zoomed out, like very high level, where is the utility helping the end user, but how is it going to fit into their overall journey? And then you had kind of the work side, which I would say like was a little more zoomed in, but still like how can the enterprise take on ways to quickly serve the customers, but also internally serve it so they can get stuff to market faster. And you have the very like day-to-day detailed.
Yeah, but I think one of the interesting things there though is how is that going to be longer term? Because if folks are quicker to switch right now, based on potentially one experience over the other, but I still potentially would want the relationship with that one institution that's going to know me for a super long time. In which case, like, I think some of the smarter services that you're seeing with the, what do they call them, banking, it's robo-advice? Or
robo-advisors.
Right? Robo-advice are more just like contextual, you know, life milestone type things. Like, oh, this person's getting into this age range. We're starting to see their purchases switch. They're using data to offer me. They might be looking for a mortgage around this time or something like that.
That's right. I think with, you look at big data, right? You look at machine learning, you look at kind of just all the, like the small fintechs have started up, and you have all the banks with the regulations. It's like us, right? So we're really looking at how can we play in the market with the fintechs. When you look at some, we talk about like APIs and stuff, and like how do we go get the consumer, and then how do we build the relationship with the consumer, I think is, you know, a big play for Capital One, right? And then taking those same experiences, and then how do we give that power and those tools to our associates that are serving those customers? Because I think then you really get like a whole full experience for both, right? Your consumer and your internal workforce.
Well, and then how can you? I think it's interesting about competing with these startup fintechs or whatever, because also their speed to market compared to being a like heavily regulated, or like how does that relationship work? Like,
yeah, that's interesting, right? It's and I think a lot of the movements that we've made, because we don't have a lot of just assets, right? We're, I think, a little bit more nimble. You know, when you look at some of the acquisitions and stuff that we've had over time, I think it's enabled us to get into more of kind of the tech side of it. And then just doing some of these really rapid developments, when you talk about some of our dev exchange, right, or open APIs, and how we plug into not only our own banks, but how do we plug into like third-party vendors and things. So essentially, we're just building our brand through these like these connections while still maintaining that security that's needed to meet those regulators.
Which goes back to your long-term relationship, which I think is built on a lot of trust. So how do you be this fast-moving organization while still maintaining trust, which is critical to the...
Which then gets back to that TechCrunch article that asserted that, you know, is the future in fintech really the established players like a Capital One leveraging these new platforms to essentially extend their own platform so that they're not losing necessarily wallet share or customer, they're just sharing it in a different way. And so that's, you know, it's interesting. I
mean, that makes sense. If they're still the backbone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Someone just comes in and builds a smaller service on top. I feel like you're starting to see that in insurance some too, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you've got
even the concept of underwriting, people have been doing that in a while just because, you know,
yeah.
I'm a turn, like a specialty insurance, but really I'm just Geico or whatever.
Right.
Kind of building on your last question though, you know, so in this, we have this kind of space, we have these fast moving things, these slow moving things, we have, you know, bigger banks and then even bigger banks, and then we have all these like smaller companies. I don't know if Ally's small. Ally's not very small, but a smaller player maybe.
Mm-hmm.
How, Paul, with all of that going on, all of this technology moving, how does a consumer or an investor kind of start evaluating decisions to you?
Yeah, so I think it's very different when you're looking at an investor or a consumer. For a consumer, I think it gets back to what we were just talking about, ease of use, trust, security, you know, protection of privacy. But I don't candidly think that on the consumer side, they're looking for a different value proposition fundamentally. They're looking for a different utility.
Mm-hmm.
In interacting with whoever is your financial well-being, whoever holding that. From an investor standpoint, though, we have to then decide and look at what we think would be those most efficient, most effective, platforms that serve that utility. So I'll say that there is, you know, we see a lot of companies that try different ways. One kind of strategy, one wedge into the consumer's life, financial life, that I think would be an optimal way to expand that utility is through just the consumer's day-to-day wallet, their bank account. I mean, if you hold a consumer's bank account, that's the account into which and out of which all the money flows for all the different, whether you're investing, whether you're credit card, paying off your credit card, whether you are getting a loan, paying off a loan, it all goes through that DDA, that demand deposit account. Broadly speaking, I'm sure there's exceptions to some point. So, you know, what are those novel ways that you get to that without having to necessarily go into the tried and true branch, meet with a banker or with a teller, and again, not to diminish their roles, but, you know, as we keep moving into the fintech space, what are some new ways to get to achieve that capture? So, my answer is not very specific because I don't know if I have a specific answer. It depends on kind of the use case that we see. Because I also know, you know, and I've seen some really creative companies that are using credit cards to essentially mimic, you know, the debit card usage and much in the same way debit cards came out and kind of mimicked credit cards. So it's almost a reverse. So I'm looking at Capital One to figure it out because they seem to be pretty innovative. So
yeah.
Well, what are some ways that then, I mean, you guys are trying to either make your organization stand out or your consumer-facing stuff, your enterprise stuff?
So again, I mean, what my role is mostly like that internal,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things that, you know, we're doing is when an associate's trying to like pull up a directory, right? Like, what's that utility? Because we have our own internal intraweb, but trying to do that from a phone is pretty gross. So really, it's just building these like really tiny, like quick hit apps, right? Where you can go in, you can pull those contacts down. And then it's really looking at ways that you stand out, because we're trying to be, you know, we're saying we're a tech company, right? So how do we draw top talent? You know, one of the things is like, how do we re-envisioned how we onboard people. When you just go in a room, you get a stack of paper, you know, a pen, and you go through this monologue, right? Someone's standing at a podium and has their laptop plugged into a screen. Well, we changed that and said, you know what, we're going to use iPads, you know, Apple TV, kind of like really changed the landscape of that. So really when you walk in now as a new employee, you don't see paper anymore. It's just, there's an iPad greeting you, you're logging in, you're creating all these connected experiences at a very like small level. It kind of says, hey, you know, your first day here, you know, you feel like you're at a tech company more.
Tech's
so
true to everything we're doing. And
all across the board. Cool. So it's really then, you know, I think there's a couple of things when you look at utility, you look kind of at an enterprise level, right? It's like, how can like that onboarding thing that serves a whole enterprise. Then you look at really these small lines of business, right? We have all our call service agents, and you know, we get calls and things where like trouble tickets and things come in. We do, you know, when you go from like Excel spreadsheets and email, like how do you change that to displaying this on a monitor, having iPads to be able to see this. Now your leader's got it on their phone. If an issue comes in, they can just pop up in the phone, and there's the whole live streaming kind of like, you know, stats and analysis. So it's really, when you look at that and you empower your workforce to do that, a lot of things move a lot quicker. And I think then it feeds into other innovation within those lines of business that say, okay, well, we're seeing all these sore spots because now we have more data. The data for us is more enriched. Now we can really narrow in on our population, provide those different services better because now all the data and stuff that we're doing behind is more enriched.
Right. I think it's interesting too with what you're bringing up that there's this dynamic between utility but also speed as a utility in the financial space. Mm-hmm. Like the faster that we're able to do things with our money, like even like the advent of things like Venmo and Zelle, these like instant transfer systems, like speed is a growing utility in the financial space. What are some ways that you guys have seen places using that or leaning on speed as a tool or something that you're interested in as an investor?
To me, I think I could build on that. I think is your experience if you walk into a bank, how quickly can you get service? You know, like we're taking a different approach where we have these new cafes. So if you go to a Short Pump Mall, you walk in there's a coffee shop, like Pete's Coffee. Then you have a couple, you know, folks walking around with iPads and stuff. If you need banking questions and stuff, you can get that service. So it's like real quick, right? So essentially, you as a consumer, you have access to these tools like immediately versus standing on long lines, kind of like antiquated processes where you have to go in and sit down and wait for somebody to talk to. Right, you really have a guide or an aide that says, hey, here's like an iPad, here's an experience, we can walk you through that. So it becomes a little bit more digital. It's almost like you're building a partnership, you know, with technology and tools that the consumer already knows.
In your world, also giving tools to your, the Capital One, I said you call them associates or advisors,
right.
So that they can also move quickly on behalf of the consumer.
That's right.
I'm going to be that guy and bring up blockchain and crypto.
I was hoping someone would, man. I'm waiting for it.
A whole nother podcast.
No, let's do it now. Let's go into blockchain. But
I think broadly speaking, when you look at speed, and this gets back to taking out of the consumer realm and going more into the enterprise realm, you know, right now our banking system is quick. I mean, you pay for something, and to the consumer, you know, it's seamless, it's easy. You pay for something, you don't have to wait for anything to clear. You walk home with the product, right? But it's all the stuff in the background. It's got to clear through the Fed. There's a lot of minutia behind the scenes. I do think blockchain, and you know, with the rise of blockchain, will help alleviate some of the kind of bottlenecks in the clearing process of funds transfers. I think a lot of the current state kind of holdups in the process are a direct result of just having to verify where the money's coming from, who, you know, what's the source and all of that. Even when you deposit a $10,000 or more check, there's a 3 to 7 day hold on it, something like that. Well, that could probably be alleviated or mitigated or eliminated with the use of blockchain and you know, where there's more transparency into the money flow. So I, you know, JP Morgan stands out as a bank that's really focusing on that, putting more resources toward it. trying to be an equal opportunity endorser here of banks, but I do think that blockchain will help with that. Cryptocurrency kind of follows that, although blockchain can exist without cryptocurrency. So that's the exciting thing, at least personally, that I see in the fintech space, is just how that's going to change the entire banking system. And you know, I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. I'm probably more cautiously optimistic about it than most, but it's definitely something to keep an eye out on and be aware of, whether you're an investor, a consumer, or an enterprise, or a small business. So we'll see.
Well, one thing, or you go ahead.
I mean, I've been following some of that to some degree, and I think it's pretty fascinating seeing whatever banks sign on, doing proof of concepts with Ripple and stuff like that. Is it supposed to be like orders of magnitude faster than Swift, or the Swift is like the protocol for transfers, right, or something? Mm-hmm. But I've been fascinated with payments overall, specifically looking, and I've been kind of beating it to death a little bit around here, but I'm fascinated at some of the case studies coming out of Eastern countries, specifically, like, as I was just talking about this yesterday with some folks, but just looking at how cash is largely irrelevant, not irrelevant, but its role has been really diminished in the States and a lot of Western countries and everything, but seems like it's all but disappearing in China almost completely, as well as cards. Everything's done via mobile pay. There's essentially QR codes. It's really funny.
Okay, here we go.
I know.
QR codes.
No, but it's because they went through this.
That's how we shop, like, sometimes, right?
So well,
that's
no, far, but
far leap.
Yeah. So I mean, in Shanghai, you can tip the buskers on the street by just you scan their, they've got their own QR code. Everybody's kind of got their own QR code, and that's essentially how you swap payments, pay for cabs, anything. And I think that's fascinating because it's through the like WeChat, Alipay family, but they're, you know, they've got like 800 million users all paying through this one sort of mobile payment platform. And I think that's pretty interesting. I've seen some cool tests too, where KFC in China, you can pay with your face. just look into a camera and they've got this machine learning thing and just snaps a photo and that's how you're paying. So really curious to see like the future of how payments have. I feel like they're going to become more and more seamless. Already Google Pay and Apple Pay like kind of take some of that away. I don't know, but they're talking about speed, which is kind of where this whole thing started. I keep thinking about speed, and especially in the workplace, because it's like, well, we can do this faster. And I, as more of like a philosophical thing, I keep, sometimes I come back to like, at what point does it, you know, like, where does it stop? Because it's like, I don't know. I don't know if like productivity and happiness are related or on a graph in any way or not. But at what point are we going to like speed ourselves out of a job completely? Or
you become more accessible, right? So yeah. The more that you enable these tools, the more accessible you become. So you can't hide.
Yeah. Right.
It's really essentially your work-life balance becomes you're on all the time.
When you mentioned that earlier, like, you know, it's great that we have all this data that we can get alerts of these critical situations, but sometimes those alerts come in at like 2 a.m. So at what point is the UX or is the enterprise responsibility to create safeguards against that speed? And at what point is speed a detriment to the utility of the product? And even Android, the latest Android release is going to have a whole bunch of like mental well-being and like, you know, at the same time, like, are the banks responsible for the financial well-being or just the financial backing of their people? I mean, of their members and stuff. Because we do work for credit unions and stuff, and one of their things is they have to provide a ton of information up front, and a lot of our designs have to be as informative and as clear as possible. And I'm sure, you know, Capital One does as well. But,
right.
You know, at what point, how do we balance that? And who drives those conversations?
Where does personal accountability, you know, kind of kick in, right? So that's a good point.
And actually, back to the speed, and it seems like we're talking a lot about also simplicity and where that comes in. And one thing I've noticed in working with financial institutions is there's a lot of off the shelf software. There's a lot of vendor relationships that you manage. You're taking modules in. And Jamie, I kind of wanted to ask you, what is the advantage of kind of moving away from some of these off-the-shelf options towards kind of custom UX, UI for your product, your brand, or your financial institution?
I think, well, you can probably identify with the work you're doing right now, but I think a tough thing to balance, and this is where it really comes to working closely together, or either that or for an organization to have an understanding of user experience at a core level, you know, not just a specialized practice, but more of a core competency of the organization. What's tough there is balancing how you design the technology such that you can do what you need on top of it. So if you're getting a bunch of different pieces from different vendors, right? So say you have this piece of functionality is coming from this vendor, this piece, and then how do you build some framework on top of that so that it all seems seamless on the other side, mm-hmm. and it works as expected? I feel like that's a reality that is probably happening in the finance world today. I know you've seen some of it, but and I feel like that's a tough one. So I feel like it's really technologies and sort of front end designer and everything really working closely to make technology decisions that will result in the best end user experience.
I think also speaking to what we were talking about earlier, when you have these fine tech, like these startup companies that are coming up and popping up as an organization that is relying on maybe these vendors, you have to find ways to make your product either compile the vendors in interesting ways to keep you up so you don't fall behind, or because I think a lot of banking decisions are based as much on kind of who your family banked with and all the traditional stuff, but also who's got a great product, who can I use quickly, you know, who's got, you know, it's not just the ATMs in your neighborhood anymore.
So, but I also think when you talk about the technology piece of it, right, I think it goes what you're saying, like the frameworks, the APIs, the things that you're building, like, can you make them reusable? How quickly can you use those things to change what your front end looks like, or the tools that you're using? Because tech's evolving so quickly. Something you build today, tomorrow, it's probably obsolete, right? Mm-hmm. Or soon after that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely.
So it's figuring out like ways to build those things in frameworks so that way when those things change, like the front end is just a front end, right? You shouldn't be able to bolt on anything on top of that. Yeah. So I think it becomes really to think about building those things smartly, trying to think ahead, right? Sometimes it's not easy when you're trying to build quickly too, but I think as long as you're doing that, I think that helps, and I think it goes a long way to be able to stay competitive with some of the smaller companies too.
Yeah. Well, and for what you guys are doing, is it having these massive like architecture discussions around the services you're building? Was it shifting Capital One? Like, kind of walk me through like how an organization can safeguard for like developing backends, developing design systems.
Yeah, that's a hard one. I can't speak to some of like kind of the external ones.
No, I know.
But I think it really comes down to just it's heavy partners, you know, with our own internal security, right? And when we build these frameworks and we create accesses and things to that data, it's how do we say, okay, we're comfortable exposing this, you know, X data in this kind of environment. But to be able to get to the other stuff, you need to come through a bunch of other gates, right? So it's really starting to pare down, like, what data do you expose and what you don't, right? And I think that helps with that safeguarding of information. And I think it's been pretty successful in the dev exchange because I think, like, the access controls and things that to come in are a little bit rigid. So it may be a little bit rigid to get in and start using some of those tools, but I think it's really, you know, we've been recognized being able to kind of protect user data, but yet expose enough to where not only our own banks can use some of those APIs, but even like third-party vendors can, you know, use some of that stuff to be able to provide like rewards or mm-hmm. products and services right from a third-party site. So essentially now we're going after the user, right, versus, you know, always sitting back and saying, hey, you know what, we're going to expect consumers to come to the bank,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's that old thinking, right? So it's how do you stay forward and, you know, reach out to them by empowering these solutions.
Which is interesting, because I think it's kind of, that shows a balance of that. I think trust is also part of our utility with the application. Like, we have to trust that the tool works,
mm-hmm,
but we also have to have
right.
the speed. And I think that a lot of that back and forth is balancing the two.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Those are, I'm not sure what kind of solution, you know, you guys are using, but that is, I know it's a little bit of a different conversation, but that's also been a tough one, just as a vendor, from a vendor's perspective too. So, and you know, different layers of how things are closed off and all that. But in the past, you know, it's been a little bit of a challenge for us sometimes to onboard with bigger clients, especially in terms of security. So where if it's, we're trying to, you know, still be agile with software development and all this, but how do we get environments to work together when like you're going through, you know, good dynamics or whatever black box is kind of walling off everything. And it, I know from my perspective, that's been, with companies worked with in the past that, that was a kind of a challenge. Definitely was getting in there and understanding how it's going to look in the end.
Right. And then you guys had that problem with us too, right? Is how do you connect into our networks and our systems, right? It's more of like we have to provide you the tools to be able to then come back into our environment, right? Versus just having just open tools. We're constantly trying to figure out, and that kind of fits into my wheelhouse, right? Is like how do we do endpoints? How do we provide endpoints in terms of not only just corporate issue devices, but just a personal device? How do we allow that to come back in and say, okay, we trust you, and what are those gates and controls that we put in place to do that? Mm-hmm. Because again, that goes back to enabling your workforce to be able to do things quickly, right? If you put a lot of gates and obstructions in the way that doesn't enable, you know, creativity or workflow, you really stifle that.
Yeah. So. And if you're, I didn't work on any of your products, so I wasn't commenting about that specifically. But have your employees found it relatively simple for onboarding in terms of understanding, you know, whatever security platform you guys use to wall off some of your more secure internal apps and things like that?
I think it depends on the line of business. That's a that's a loaded question. I think we try to. We're constantly trying to improve how when someone comes in is like, what's their experience? So trying to figure out, and I think it goes back to like machine learning and learning your new associates that are coming in and say, okay, what's that user profile? And then build and have like tools and things ready for them as they walk to their desk. Like here, custom solution, all your accesses, everything is done.
That's smart.
Right? That's almost like kind of like that pre-onboarding stage of like, how do we get there? But a lot of that comes with trust, where like we have to figure out like, do we trust this new person that we haven't really fully brought in yet with some of these tools? So it's really kind of, it's a hard line to walk. So we're constantly trying to figure out like, what is the right answer to be able to make those folks productive day one.
Well, I'd be also interested to see how much farther, when you guys are doing like a vendor like we were, how much farther your dollar goes when you have a really succinct onboarding process that gets them hooked in so that they can, you know, when you're spending money on them, they can start working for you almost immediately. Because then that's really business for you guys.
That's right. I think when just for you guys, for example, I think it took us a week and a half to really fully get everything stood up, all the accesses and things like that.
And that was probably one of the faster ones.
Oh my gosh.
That
I've
been a part of.
We have ones where it's
months or like a month or two.
We try to pride ourselves on being pretty quick to hook in, but I mean, the security's there for a reason, and like it's good reason.
Yeah.
Like,
And you're not the only industry. I mean, healthcare, education, it's you know, the more regulated industries because of privacy and data. I mean, I think those that will win out, when I say those, I mean the innovative technologies and platforms, the winners at the end of the day are the ones that are going to embrace versus resist the regulations, because the regulations are not going to go away. Mm-hmm. So you've got to find a way to, and not even work around them, but work alongside them. And they're there at the end of the day for valid reasons. So, you know, that's, we don't really, or we haven't to date, our fund is not invested in regulations technologies, but I'm not an expert in that, but I just, that's kind of my gut sense with respect to weighing that those types of technologies against the technologies that are core for fintech or edtech or healthcare tech, whatever.
Do you see that as an advantage for larger financial institutions because they could potentially be more well versed in it, or is that?
No, I actually think they could be because I think at the end of the day they're still going to be too big. It's the proverbial, you know, how quickly can you turn the Titanic versus a 22-foot skiff or something. But I will say that they have the institutional knowledge and the I think political capital to help a smaller startup navigate those waters, and getting back again to that article that I referenced at the beginning that we've been kind of talking about with, you know, to what extent do the traditional incumbents embrace the competitive startups versus ignoring them, and maybe that's one area that they come together on to try to, you know, both get through together. So I
100% agree with you. I think the key is when you look at regulation, it's easy to say, you know, we're going to pull a wall up and say we're going to lock everything down, right? It's really working with inside your own organization and saying, you know, like, what does that mean? Like, what are our requirements? Like, what do we actually have to do? And then letting, you know, your technologists come in and say, okay, I can solve that by doing this. So, because the emerging technologies keep coming, right? And if you put the wall up, the emerging technologies eventually are just going to go over your wall anyway. You're going to lose. So I think taking a defensive approach is bad for the financials industry, right? So I think it's just saying, okay, we know new technology is coming. What are the regulators saying, and how can we take that new technology and build the right framework so when the new stuff starts coming out, it's like, hey, we can pivot there, we can change there, right?
Yeah.
While still maintaining all the regulations and rules that are required of a bank.
Yeah, that's a great insight.
I think that's a smart way to do it too, because it, you know, from a consumer perspective, those regulations in part, I mean, are the reason why I trust my bank with all my data. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like somebody has to be accountable on the other end, you know, versus, you know, it's some of the, especially in a little bit more like Wild West, you know, you mentioned like cryptocurrency space. That's a lot of reason why you see, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars go missing.
Or do you see lately the big fraud cases going on?
Yeah.
The fraudulent coins?
Yeah, SEC put out a fake website to show how easy it was for an ICO to...
Oh, yeah.
Again, a whole nother topic for another
podcast.
Right.
A different thing, but...
Fascinating.
All I'm saying is I couldn't... I agree with you guys.
Well, speaking of, like, you know, talking about those technologies that are going to come over that wall, what are some, like, interesting new techs that we're hearing about or that are coming along the way or we're seeing? Crypto, we mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, from an investor standpoint, I mean, blockchain, crypto... you know, but more kind of in keeping with the less frontier driven and more kind of current state. You know, we're seeing, without getting specific, you know, novel ways of partnering. So again, startups partnering with traditional banks to deliver a mobile-first, cloud-based banking experience. So neobanks, the rise of neobanks.
That's the first time hearing that. What does that mean?
Yeah, you can Google that, because I don't know if I'll give a great answer. it's basically, you know, a hybrid between that, you know, corner brick-and-mortar bank versus, again, this... e-banking type of think of e-surance, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
e-surance, I know that's kind of getting into another subset of fintech, but you can, you know, that's largely driven mobile, virtual. So I'm butchering the answer, but the neobank kind of concept enables startups that are trying to get that wallet share, that demand deposit wallet share from a customer. It enables them to do that when they don't have the capital or the desire to put up brick and mortar, but yet they also understand, getting back to the trust, that maybe there's a bank in the Midwest, you know, somewhere in the Midwest that... no judgment, by the way, on the geography, but somewhere in the Midwest that has a few banks
mm-hmm.
in a state or a tri-state area, and you know they are trying to gather market share from some of the big incumbents, and one way they can do that is partnering with an online solution that is outside of their own creation. But you know, you partner, and so you see some lead gen opportunities, you see some wallet share opportunities. Maybe it's that, you know, the neobank then is a hybrid of, again, it's what we've been talking about, this this mix between the old and the new.
It's,
so,
it's kind of how like Bank of Canvas is like the servicer for Ally or something,
that's,
right?
That's a much quicker and better probably answer to what I just said. So
I don't think it's that.
Apologize to all the listeners.
I don't think
terrible.
That's the exact scenario. Well, but, on the kind of a different way of for Mason's question, weren't there just like some big, it was like the FinTech Awards in New York like a month ago or something? I was going to see if you guys, I was hoping you guys were familiar so I could see who are the big winners.
There's so many different.
Are there?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, there's Money 2020, which is a big, big fintech. Big fintech thing. There's the JP Morgan, you know, fintech conference out west. There's a lot of those.
Are
so
there?
Not, right now, or maybe last week, spanning into this week, in New York, there's the blockchain and cryptocurrency kind of summit that has a lot of. So there's a whole lot of.
Gotcha.
Of this, but we're still, NRV is still a smaller fund, so we don't necessarily get all of those, but try to keep our pulse on what's around us, and it definitely helps with Capital One being such a good partner in the market. So.
Well, and I mean, we were talking about some new experiences. Like, I know you guys have these, and maybe you can answer from the associate side. You know, what are some things that you guys are doing that are new, or some things that you're seeing from other, whether it's competitors or people in the space that are really helping the associate or enterprise side?
I think one of the big things is our move to Google, right? I think that's a big change for, I think, how you talk about financial companies, right? Where it's, you know, Office 365 is a little bit more contained to this kind of web-based tool set, right? So it's moving to that, and then how do you then create continued experiences for the associates, right? Through building different extensions and things like that. So what does that look like? Because, you know, the number of extensions and capabilities is endless when you're looking at those kind of tools. That's kind of the newer stuff that we're working on. And then, you know, continuing to build like integrations with even like some of the current tools. You look at Slack, you look at chat for Google, like how do some of those things continue to evolve and change? And then you look at, well, how do you create some of those connected experiences and the solutions that you build, right? So it's that constant building for your associates and try to make things simpler, right? When you have like five or six different tools, then you kind of defeat your purpose, right? Where you're like, now you're answering five different chats, right?
You're spending so much time picking which tool is appropriate.
That's right. So then figuring out like, how do you streamline some of those and say, okay, you know, this is, we're going to stay efficient, but like, how do we continue to evolve with all these current technologies? So it never stops, right? So especially in my space, we're always evaluating what are the new tools out there? How can we use them? How does that improve the user experience? Like example for the Google stuff that we're trying to roll out.
That's cool. I didn't realize you guys were switching over. That's cool.
So when you say switching over, you mean like you guys were moving to like G Suite or?
Oh yeah, G Suite.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
That's a huge hamstring for other financial institutions, which is like getting dragged down and just even sharing spreadsheets is just difficult.
Yeah, and I think that just goes to, you know, Rich's statement. Like we're a tech company, right? We want to, you know, I know we have that bank tag, but we really want to evolve, you know, in that space. Because I think that's the how you're going to stay competitive with Apple and Google, some of these smaller fintech companies, right? They don't have the power of the money and the bank like we do, and the experience of, like what you're saying, with all the regulations and stuff. But we also are not as nimble as some of those, where we can quickly move. But if we really build out a good tech environment, we can stay with, you know, those folks, because we have that backing of that financial backing.
I think one thing that I've seen, this is probably like super granular, but that we've been fascinated with for projects we've worked on in the financial space, but also other projects, is just the opportunities that could exist. We have so much location data, we have so much mobile, you know, we're always on our devices, and there's opportunities for the financial space to maybe get involved in, whether it's community-based financial projects or community-based, finding ways to show you both financial literacy based on you relative to like your peers around you and giving you information relative to that, but also finding ways of like you know, I've always been fascinated with, like, the way Kickstarter came on the scene and, like, the way you can give money. And the way that we use money now is so different than it was even, like, 10 years ago. And just seeing where that goes in terms of...
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was just... Before coming into this, I was kind of thinking about where that fit in terms of some of the things that people are looking for in their bank. Particularly, I'm thinking about, like, Swell, for example. It's a trading or an investment platform. But it's more ethics-based, I guess.
Social good.
Yeah, like, so it allows you to invest in companies that are, I think their tagline is something like contributing to solving a global problem or something, right? So
it's like an episode of Silicon Valley.
I know.
Is it really?
It's good for the world.
Yeah, maybe it was a joke site or something.
No, it's true.
I know, but it's real.
Even there's community, is it community lending, or it's an investment service where you can make big investment groups with hundreds of people. I can't remember what it's called. But I think that that's also a space that's, it hasn't been hit super hard yet, but there could be something there.
So I know Capital One, right, we do like financial literacy. We go through high schools and things and do those kind of, you know, forward-thinking things. You talked about 1717, you know, like the space where we're kind of like, in the, you know, the incubators, right, for mm-hmm. new ideas and things. So I think there's always a lens we have on that. I probably can't speak to all of them, but I know that, you know, one of our tenants, right, is just like, how do we give back, right? Mm-hmm. And how do we continue to move that bar?
Yeah, I mean, it's what you were saying. It's impact in the crowd. And you mm-hmm. see in however many different flavors. So Swell, for instance, is I think, a, you know, hitting on a, I'm not going to call it a pain point, but a very real sentiment among a very powerful and growing consumer base that is the millennial. I mean, you know, not to say that no other consumer base or population base shares the same, you know, desire or affinity for those, for, you know, the crowd and impact. But I've, you know, that the millennial population is driving, I mean, is driving a lot of that. So it is a legitimate, I guess, force to consider.
When you have a giant millennial consumer base that are picking their bank, that could be the thing.
Yeah,
to decide
for sure.
One or the other. And the sober business side of it is we want them to choose our bank.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's how we stay in business.
Especially if the cost of switching is less. No. Yeah. I feel like you usually get your first bank account because of wherever your parents' bank, right?
Or something. The college I went to was like, hey, you get Wachovia.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'll get Wachovia.
But I mean, it's, you know, remember you used to be held captive by the cell phone companies,
yeah,
because you couldn't take your phone number or they made it too expensive. Switching mm-hmm. costs were high, so what do? They eliminated it. I mean, largely speaking.
Yeah.
So now it's a lot easier, with the exception of the fact that now you get a, you know, installment plan your phone that's like more than a car these days. But bottom line is, I think you're right. The switching costs is something we haven't really touched on, and I don't think we have time to do it here, but that is also a huge pain point. And I think, and I've said it, I used to be in banking, and I've said it from, you know, the first, you know, day one when I was in it, whoever figures out how to make it easier to switch banks in terms of your demand deposit accounts is really, that's, to me, one of the holy grails of fintech. Personally speaking, I just think that that'll create a lot of good things and hold a lot of institutions more accountable.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, make it easier to switch. So we'll see.
Well, if someone does that right, I think a lot of people might get rocked a little bit.
Oh, no doubt.
It's like,
no doubt.
Talk about something that could be a huge disruption.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, this room is very warm.
Yeah, it is a little bit.
We covered a lot, and I think that, you know, if anything, there's more I'd love to talk about with this space. And,
yeah,
you know, down the line. But I really appreciate you guys hanging out in this room, sweating it out in the rainy day.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
This was good.
That was cool. That was a lot of fun.
Thanks for tuning in to our second episode of Mobile by Design. This podcast was produced and directed by Olya Polishik, and I'm your host, Mason Brown. For more information, please go to shaco.com/ideas. You can follow us on Twitter @Shaco and Instagram @Shaco_RVA.